Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases the stories and radio productions from this and many other community stations across the country. I'm Elizabeth Finn of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Today on Sprouts, we visit Valdivia, Chile, a city that in 1960 experienced the most powerful earthquake in recorded history, followed by a devastating tsunami. We explore three stories of survival: the ecological survival of a unique wetland created by the earthquake, the cultural survival of Mapuche, a local indigenous group, and the personal survival of those who lived through the earthquake and resulting tsunami.
The smell of raw fish wavers in the air. Berries, vegetables, and seaweed overflow the temporary booths. Sea lions jump from the river onto concrete pillars to be fed discarded fish. Merchants shout out the variety of fish they're selling, and the market goers crowd around interesting-looking seafood. This would seem an unconventional place for college students to visit on spring break. We came all the way from MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to this misty city in Chile's Southern Lakes region to study something that happened decades ago. Valdivia Central Market is actually 2 to 3 meters below where it stood 50 years ago. The largest earthquake in recorded history, 9.5 on the Richter scale, hit the city in 1960, destroying buildings and sinking the land. Minutes later, a giant tsunami created by the quake hit the coast, flooding the city and the entire region. The market where we stood on that Sunday morning was washed away and rebuilt years later. But none of that was on our minds that day.
Oh, it's corn!
My name is Elizabeth, and I'm from Illinois. We don't see much corn in Cambridge, Massachusetts, so I was excited to find my favorite grain in Valdivia's market.
Eat it! It's sweet!
I'm Samrit, and I really like fruits. Although I risked massive diarrhea and being miserable for the rest of the trip, the local fruits were so tempting I had to try them on spot.
He offered me some, but I didn't want to risk it. His berries did look good, though.
I'm Allison, and I was trying to interview all the people I could find. There were some policemen who looked like they could talk about the city.
They didn't want to be interviewed on tape. My name is Rodrigo, and I was off investigating sea lions. After we left the fish market, however, we went on our separate, more serious missions.
Okay, fine.
I think it'd be hard for us to get
near the marketplace. We boarded the Orion 3, a small touring boat, to visit the Carlos and Wander Sanctuary. This is a special sanctuary because it didn't exist only a couple decades ago. It was formed by the Chilean earthquake of 1960.
The earthquake caused this rural area to sink 3 meters down. Both croplands and forests were soon underwater. Today, the ghostly remains of tree trunks can be seen poking over the water's surface.
Allison and I are interested in learning about new ecosystems, so we were on the lookout for cool new birds and plants. But as we stepped onto the boat, we noticed graffiti layered over the dock cement walls. I thought that the picture of a swan with a distinctive black neck was an attempt to attract visitors to the boat's touring business, but then Rod translated. That means, the swans die, then we die. Rod's translation shocked me. I like swans, and I like me, and I don't want either of us to die. The graffiti artist wasn't exaggerating. The wetlands are extremely close to Valdivia, and whatever caused the swan's death might easily spread to Valdivian's water supply or fishing grounds.
The aquatic plants that the swans eat have been struggling to survive in recent years, probably due to pollution. Their difficulties have spread to the black-necked swans. If the problems with the sanctuary are not fixed, they can also spread to humans.
As we cruise through the wetland, we watch trees and water slide by, while our tour guides proudly describe the incredible number of swans that used to inhabit the area.
You will see almost no bird. It used to be here about 4,000. 4,000, 5,000, the minimum number of swan, but in some year we used to have up to 12,000, 14,000 swan in this area.
4,000 swans minimum? I saw groups of swans far off in the distance, but probably only about 30 during the whole boat ride.
The black-necked swans are what ecologists call a flagship species. They're cute and fuzzy and serve as a symbol of conservation for both academics and graffiti artists in Chile. Public interest in the swans enables researchers to raise money to protect the entire sanctuary. Eduardo Silva, a veterinary student, told us why the swans have become the Valdivian symbol of conservation.
People always talk about swans, but there are many other species that have problems too. but there's no evidence to talk about it, and Chile has problems because there's not so much money for research.
Because of this, nobody can prove much about what the sanctuary was like before early 2004. That's when a pulp mill began to operate upstream.
Many people accused the mill of polluting the sanctuary. It voluntarily closed in June when faced with two Supreme Court charges, pollution of a nature sanctuary, and the use of a false report to defend itself in court. As we came closer and closer to the sanctuary, the dark blue of the river turned into a tea-colored brown. Everyone leaned over the side of the boat to take a look, while Professor Eduardo Jaramillo explained what we were seeing.
The trees, they have a lot of heavy metal.
Uh-huh.
And you process a lot.
I see.
I later heard that the plant discharges waste into the river at a rate of 6 liters per second. That's like 3 2-liter pop bottles of sludge every second. This is okay in the river, because the strong current mixes up the sludge. Once the pollution reaches the wetland, however, things turn ugly.
The sludge stops moving, and its particles stay suspended just beneath the surface of the water. Plants and animals within the sanctuary ingest the pollution, along with their food and water. University researchers think that many parts of the sanctuary are dying because the pollution is poisoning them. Since the swans have no food to eat, they are leaving for better hunting grounds.
Groups like Acción por los Cisnes, or Action for the Swans, are fighting to close down the pulp mill so that the wetland can heal. Although it's sad that the swans are leaving, I couldn't help but smile as I saw the environmentalist graffiti lining Valdivia's alleyways and dockside walls. It's impressive to see an entire city mobilized, from distinguished university professors to anonymous graffiti artists.
Elizabeth and I were interested in popular environmental issues, while Siamron's curiosity was drawn towards a group of people called the Mapuche, the indigenous population of Chile.
I found out about the Mapuche while doing some research to learn more about Valdivia. I had no idea a native population exists in Chile. Professor Juan Carlos Excuse, an anthropologist from La Universidad Austral de Chile, told me a little bit more about the Mapuche.
First of all, the Mapuche people are the main indigenous group of the country. And not only of the country. The Mapuche people, if you kind of look backwards in their history, is one of the largest groups in South America, and even in the Americas. The Mapuche, at some point in their history, covered the entire area that went from Santiago to Buenos Aires to Puerto Montt.
The Mapuche were a successful and strong group of people who resisted Spanish forces until the 1880s, when they were finally defeated by the Chilean army. That really did not surprise me. You read about native populations getting conquered all the time. It's sad, but it's true. But one thing that I learned that struck me the most was what Chris, our tour guide, told me about how the Mapuche currently are being discriminated against in Chilean society.
Like a good last name, you know. You don't want to have a native last name. It's very hard for you in Chile to try to gain things if your last name is native, you know. You're going to be looked down on you, you know. People's going to look down on you.
It's interesting, the ideas of names. It's so 1800s or something that maybe happened in the past, but in this day and age, shouldn't be happening. It's sad to see that this sort of discrimination still is happening and that you can be judged by your name and not by really who you are. I brought this issue up with Jose Cayaman, a groundskeeper where we were staying. He is a Mapuche, but instead of answering me directly, Jose hedged. He avoided directly saying if he is being discriminated against, like it was something he did not want to acknowledge.
Eso ocurre siempre. Siempre es.
That always occurs.
En algunas partes, no, sí.
In some places, it is not like that.
Se respeta la persona como es.
People respect the way we are.
Y hay gente que no lo miran así.
And there are people that don't look at things that way.
Miran de otra manera la persona.
They look at people in a different way.
Cada cual tiene su idea.
Everyone has their own ideas.
It was clear to me that there is a problem, that Jose and his people are not being treated fairly, and names are just a superficial detail in the problem.
We're calm and we stay still. We just listen. We do things the way they tell us to do. So we don't have any trouble. The main difference between Chileans and Mapuche is that we speak more softly.
It was, in fact, more than just the problem of discrimination that the Mapuche faced, as I soon found out. Since 1980, Chile has opened itself to the world market, and the Chilean economy has been growing rapidly. Lumber companies have bought up many acres of land in the area, enclosing the Mapuche communities in the countryside. Professor Juan Carlos Excuse explains.
The state was subsidizing like the exotic plantations of pine trees and eucalyptus. And that meant for the Mapuche communities a very kind of painful process, because on the one hand, they became like the only inhabitants that couldn't be forced out because the new laws protect the land. So those indigenous lands are out of the market. But for the timber industry, that was a problem because they couldn't move into these lands. And what they did was just to plant around these communities.
As a result, the Mapuche became isolated because the plantations were cutting them off from the main roads and the general region. The Mapuche now have little access to natural resources like firewood and wild fruits, one-third of their income that was free to them in the past.
I want things the way they used to be. People the way they were born. Everyone doing whatever they want. We could grow crops. Today people don't grow crops anymore. Because you need to have a permit for that. To work the wood and all that. There's a resource management plan in place.
La gente mapuche está dominada por el chileno.
The Chileans dominate the Mapuche people.
Ya no va a cambiar.
And it's not going to change.
As a result, many Mapuche left their homes in the countryside to find work. Displaced from their community, Jose and possibly many others are sadly experiencing the gradual disappearance of their culture.
People that speak the language are few and scattered everywhere.
Ya se ha ido perdiendo esa tradición de antes.
The tradition is slowly being lost.
Hablo algo.
I speak a little bit.
No sabe hablar. No entiende tampoco.
My son doesn't understand any Mapuche.
Ni que cuando se cría uno con los viejitos.
When you grow up with the old people.
Eso ya le enseñan de todo, pues lo mandan.
They teach you everything.
Haga esto, pero lo dicen en lengua, Mapuche.
They talk to you in Mapuche.
Ya hoy en día no.
But not today.
Hoy en día se hace la cuestión todo en castellano. ¿No?
Everything today is in Spanish.
The discrimination against the Mapuche people by some Chileans is also having ill effects on the Mapuche culture.
La gente Mapuche ya ha perdido todo el idioma de hablar.
Mapuche people have lost their entire language.
Entonces por ahí ya como que le da vergüenza la juventud hoy en día.
So today young people are embarrassed.
No es como antes.
Not like before.
Hablaban, se preguntaban cómo está, todo en lengua, Mapuche.
People used to say hello in the Mapuche language.
Pero hoy en día no.
But not today.
Se burlan de lo demás, entonces por ahí ya como que la gente ya.
Today people make fun of it.
No le da ganas hablar de esa palabra de Mapuche en lengua.
So some Mapuches don't really want to talk in Mapuche anymore.
I don't know how I would feel if my people, my culture, the world that I know were to slowly fade away. I think it was the utter passive acceptance of a horrible truth that made it hard for me to keep my composure, as Jose told me what he sees for the future of his people.
Yo creo que de a poco se va a terminar la gente Mapuche, porque ya no queda.
Little by little, the Mapuche people will end because there are so few of us left.
Casi la mayoría se han vuelto chilenos.
The few of us that remain have become mostly Chilean.
Han cambiado sus tradiciones.
And have changed the traditions.
En vez le da vergüenza hasta dar su apellido, su nombre.
Some even are embarrassed to give last name because it's Mapuche.
La gente se va terminando.
And so the people are ending little by little.
Before coming to Chile, I really did not know much about the Mapuche, and that they were being discriminated against, and that they, as a people, an entire cultural entity, is dying. It's just not right.
Mama, yeah, mama, yeah, mama, yeah, mama, yeah, we, yeah, we, yeah.
Valdivians who lived through the 1960 earthquake fear their stories will one day die as well. It's sad, but slowly these stories are being lost. This is Rodrigo, and I like listening to stories, so I wanted to find some stories from those who experienced a disaster firsthand. Leonardo Mancini was a teacher in Valdivia in 1960. We were on the riverbank, opposite the city center, the night he told me his story.
Yo estaba en mi casa, como les comentaba, a dos cuadras del centro de Valdivia.
I was in my house, two blocks down from the center of Valdivia, two blocks from the plaza in the main street, the Picarte Avenue. That's where I lived, and nothing was left because my house was built on a lake.
Unknown to him at the time, his house was situated on an ancient lake bed. Along with the rest of the city, it collapsed in only a few seconds. He described it as being the end of the world. Leonardo still misses some buildings, reminders of the old Valdivia that's now replaced with the city before us.
You miss a lot of things. For example, that building used to look like a castle. It was Valdivia's beer factory. You miss, for example, the fire department's tower. It was tall and had four clocks, one on each face. For 20 or 30 years afterwards, I'd look up to see the time and it wasn't there. Things like that happen to you. But little by little, things get rebuilt.
As devastating as the earthquake was, it wasn't the only disaster to hit the area that day. A few miles from Valdivia, picturesque towns and fishing villages lined the coast. Approaching towards these at an incredible speed was a maremoto, or tsunami, that was to wipe them all out.
There was a very strong earthquake. The ground cracked and opened in places. Suddenly, we looked toward the sea, and a tremendous tide was coming.
Edna Pacheco was in Chiole, one of the devastated villages that day. She still lives there, much higher up a hill, though. She recently started a gymnastics club with some friends and walks daily to the nearest gym in the next village. She told me her story on her way back from gym class. A kind woman in her 80s, she still remembers, with some difficulty, what she and her town went through that day.
We took off toward the mountain. Everyone did. Some stayed behind, though, the ones that drowned. There was a party up in the hill, and when the people were coming down, that's when the wave got them. It came up the river dragging boats. It went up that way. There came our house. We saw it as it was going by. What a shame.
I asked her if it's something she still remembers often. Her reply was that she remembers it every day of her life, as though it were a bad dream. She says it's something that those who live through will never forget. To lighten the mood, one of her friends couldn't help but make a joke. She said they had a gym club, so that if there ever were to be another tsunami, they'd be able to run away. Only a few miles from where Erna stood, tangible proof of the tsunami still haunts the seaport. The masts and chimneys of a sunken steamer, the Canelo, have been rusting for over 40 years and still protrude from the water, a grim reminder of the many ships that sank because of the tsunami in the shallow waters of the bay. Hilda Normand accompanied us as we toured the area by boat. She had been here that day on the sunken Canelo.
I had lunch there that day, in that steamer. It was in Corral Bay.
What do you feel when you see that ship?
What do I feel? It's been so many years. It was a nice steamer, a very nice ship.
Only a few hours before it sank, she was on the very ship that now lies dead in the bay. 46 years later, and just a few feet away from the rusty remains, Hilde was telling me about her lunch that day. It was chilling to see the ship so close, yet so different from how it used to be. And even more striking to see Hilde's reaction.
This place, the ship that you see on your right side, was the bay.
Her expression and mood changed as soon as our guide announced the wrecks on the PA, and her attention was captured by the aging iron. She stood up, pointed, and told me the story behind the ship. Her father was a sea captain, so after lunch on the Canelo, she went to meet him at a reception on another boat. That's where she was when the tsunami struck, on a boat that also now lies beneath the waves.
Y entre la primera y la segunda ola, de repente como que vino algo y se secó.
Between the first and second wave, suddenly something happened and the area in front of us dried up, about 500 meters in front of the ship. A sort of crater formed and a small passenger steamship fell in. We were right on the verge of falling in as well. The houses that floated were dragged out by the sea, while we were dragged in and out on the ship. There were men on the roofs of the houses that were taken, and they say that many of those survived. How? I have no idea. The people that were in the mountains later told us they couldn't explain how the steamship didn't flip over. We couldn't say, because with the fear and desperation that we were feeling at the moment, the only thing I wanted at that point was to die quickly.
For survivors like Edna, Hilde, and Leonardo, their experiences in 1960 are very much a part of their lives today. Like them, many still haven't been able to get over the tragedy. Other survivors, however, focus on the reconstruction and revival of Valdivia and of their lives. Pelusa van de Maile was in Valdivia when the earthquake struck.
Most old people in Valdivia still cry, still complain, and are still crushed. But I think that shouldn't be. It should give you strength to get over that stage, because it's a stage, and it happened to many people, not just you. You can't hold on to the tragedy, to how terrible it was. It's over, you're alive, and you can get up. That's the most important thing. In the end, it was something positive.
After the earthquake, to avoid the flooding, Pelusa fled to the island where the Universidad Austral has its campus. There, where her husband was a professor, she lived for over a year. They took over a small office, and with small children, they were able to survive until they could build a new house. She is now in the process of compiling a book of poetry about the earthquake and the tsunami. I visited her house one night, and amidst raspberry meringue cake, she read us her favorite poem, Primavera hacia el sur, Spring for the South.
Ahora necesita ventanas y navíos para esperar de nuevo la vida sur del mundo. Porque en medio de todo la primavera vuelve y hay que vendar los árboles que rompieron las olas.
Written by Chilean ecologist Sara Vial, the poem talks of the spring being carried by boats to the devastated towns of southern Chile.
Guardabosque perdido de la red y la barca que arrebató el océano.
It mentions how even though broken lamps have to be fixed and trees have to be bandaged, you shouldn't hang on to the grief forever. It says that even though the city's gone through much suffering, help is being sent from ports around the world. And, with courage, Valdivia and its people will recover.
This piece was produced in Terrascope Radio, a class developed by the MIT Terrascope Program in collaboration with the MIT Program in Comparative Media Studies. Terrascope is part of MIT's Earth System Initiative. Terrascope Radio is taught by Ari Epstein, along with teaching assistants Orit Kuritsky and Vanessa Bertose.
The program was written and produced by Allison St. Vincent,
Siamrit Patanovich, Rodrigo Zeladon,
and Elizabeth Finn.
Translations were written by Rodrigo Zeladon and voiced by members of the MIT community.
A special thanks to Deborah Axel and Ruth Beinrib of Terrascope and Chris Bobko of WMBR. We'd also like to thank the professors and students of La Universidad Austral de Chile, with special thanks to Teodoro Calso and Antonio Lara.
Thank you for listening.
To learn more about the Terrascope program, go to web.mit.edu/terrascope.
You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly news magazine produced by this community station and many others across the country. Coming up, more from Terrascope Radio. Two MIT students get a close-up look at animals and birds of the Galapagos Islands. This is an excerpt from a longer documentary exploring ecological pressures in the Galapagos created by the fishing and tourism industries. Look for the entire program in a future edition of Sprouts.
Bartolome Island looks brown and barren from a distance. One side gently slopes upward out of the ocean, meeting the craggy cliffs on the other side in a distinct pinnacle. As our boat approaches, I can see that the island isn't as desolate as it appears. Cacti and low-lying gray shrubs have managed to grow in the meager pockets of dirt in the lava rock. As I step out of the boat, brown lava lizards the size of my finger scurry away. When they stop, they blend so well with the rock that I lose sight of them. Birds wheel overhead. A hot breeze swirls around.
As I walk along the rocky coast of Bartolome, Juan Carlos, our guide, stops to point out a cluster of brownish-green marine iguanas feeding in the water below.
Don't forget, these are the only sea-going lizards in the world, and that one is diving down right now. That's exactly what they do. They just dive down deep as 30, 40 feet. Unbelievable. And they can hold their breath for up to half an hour.
A gray and white bird drops straight into the water near the iguanas. It's a blue-footed booby looking for food.
The boobies will go straight down, right in front of the fish. Like that, see? See how he made it all the way down? So when he passed the fish, he provokes this turbulence that traps the fish. And at the last moment, when he just passed it, he turns and grabs it from the head.
Our group works its way up to the island's crest. The sun beats down, scorching through clothes and sunscreen. From the top, we see a bright aqua bay and a white beach. An ancient volcanic crater is submerged in the bay, visible only as a perfect circle of light blue water that stands out brilliantly from the darker sea. The wind blows harder.
30 kilometers away from Bartolome, I step off a boat onto North Seymour Island. I'm amazed to see sea lions basking on the rocks only feet away, paying little attention to me. A particularly bold one approaches. It stops and makes a startling noise. It's hard to tell if this noise is anger, curiosity, or something else. I stare, awestruck, as the sea lion moves past, grunting the whole time. I've never experienced such fearlessness in a wild animal before. The sea lion continues on its way, uninterested.
Three male blue-footed boobies are courting one female. They stand in a semicircle around her, competing for her attention. As they whistle, the males point their wings and beaks at the sky dramatically. They rock from foot to foot, showing off bright blue webbed feet. The female honks back. After much deliberation, the female approaches one of the males. He snatches a twig from the ground and offers it to her. They touch beaks. A choice has been made, and the failed suitors wander off.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Terrascope Radio at MIT. Sprouts is distributed and coordinated by Pacifica Radio Network. Thanks to Michael Yoshida at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts, to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Elizabeth Finn in Cambridge, Massachusetts. See you next week on Sprouts.